nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so as you know, the first few lectures, we were talking about a general model for nano devices, where the input was this density of states and how easily it connects to the contacts. And as I mentioned at that time, that this density of states, of course, if you take it as a given, then after that you can continue and calculate current voltage characteristics. But one of the things we need to discuss at length is, like, how do you understand this density of states? How do you model it? Where does that come from? And that's where the starting point is usually, again, the Schrodinger equation. So, and as I mentioned, this work kind of started about 100 years ago, trying to understand the energy levels in, like, the simplest material you could imagine, and that's the hydrogen atom. And as I said, the first success of this Schrodinger equation back in 1925 was that it could predict precisely the energy levels in a hydrogen atom, which consists of this positive nucleus and with the electron tied to that nucleus by the Coulomb force. And classically, the electron could have had any energy, but what this Schrodinger equation showed, predicted, was that there would be certain specific energies at which you could find solutions to this equation. Actually, non-trivial solutions to this equation, because the trivial solution of phi equals zero, that's always available. But non-zero solutions, that can only be obtained at certain specific energies. Now, as I mentioned, one of the things I meant to discuss, and that's exactly what I'll do today, is describe to you a numerical way of solving this Schrodinger equation. Of course, Schrodinger originally, you know, he solved this analytically, because this was a problem that actually had analytical solutions. And unfortunately, though, hydrogen atom is like the only one for which you have analytical solutions. Anything more complicated, you really need numerical methods anyway. And the power of the numerical method is that once you have set it up, you can do all kinds of problems easily, because you can easily change parameters and see what happens and things like that. But the tricky part, of course, first is setting it up and making sure you have done it right, because otherwise you are just calculating all kinds of wrong things. Okay. Now, so what I'll describe to you is this method that you can easily implement on your computer. I mean, on a laptop, it's a short MATLAB code you can write easily, and you can calculate energy levels and all kinds of things. And that's what I try to describe to you today. And what we'll do is start with this one-dimensional version of this equation. So let's say we have something like E phi equals so we are talking about one dimension. Let's call that dimension the x dimension. And I'll assume that nothing varies in the other two dimensions. As you know, this operator, this Laplacian operator, it is actually given by the sum of three terms. In general, there's just three things. And for this discussion, for the moment, let's drop these two and say that we have a problem in one dimension, x. So what we are solving then is this equation. And we want to find I guess, solutions to this equation, you know, and specific energy values at which you can find those solutions, etc. Now, any numerical method for solving this equation, the way it usually works is that you turn this differential equation into a set of algebraic equations. As I mentioned before, that, you know, algebraic equations, there's a well-defined way of solving them. On the other hand, with differential equations, there is really no well-defined way as such. It's like you write down a solution, see if it works or not. And often you can do that analytically, and people have a nice catalog of solutions and so on. But if you have to solve a new differential equation numerically, almost any method consists of turning this into, approximately into, a set of algebraic equations. Okay? So what I'll describe to you today is one way of doing that. You see, it's called the finite difference method. That's just one way of doing it. There are other ways of turning differential equations into a set of algebraic equations. And depending on the problem at hand, some of them might work better than others. Okay? But there's one way that's relatively straightforward, and that's what I want to tell you today. And that one works like this, that let's say this is the x-axis, and the point is that usually, of course, this x-axis is a continuous variable. That is, x can have any value in there. But let us say we assume that x is a like a discrete variable, like it has only certain allowed values, you know, which are spaced by a distance a. So what happens then is that this phi of x, it becomes, so, you know, this is x, so usually, so you have a function that looks like this. This is phi of x. But once you adopt a discrete lattice, what you have is a discrete set of values. So at this point, you have some value of phi. Here you have some other value, you have some other value. So you just have a discrete set. So if you got 100 points in your lattice, you got 100 values of phi, which you could write in the form of a column vector. So instead of phi of x, that's what has sort of become this column vector. And what I'll show you is that this differential operator here, you could turn that into a matrix. And then this phi is again a column vector. And this matrix, its size is n by n. Now, exactly what this matrix is, how you write it down, that we'll talk about in a minute. Okay? But the end result is just this, that that differential equation can be turned into an equivalent matrix equation. And as you know, a matrix equation is really just a collection of 100 algebraic equations. I mean, 100 if n is equal to 100. Basically, it's a collection of n algebraic equations. Why is that? Well, when I write something like this, so let's say I got some numbers here, you know, 1, 2, this may be 3.1, etc., whatever this matrix is. The first, you know, this matrix equation is really like a set of algebraic equations. The first equation being E times phi 1 is equal to 1 times phi 1 plus 2 times phi 2 plus 3.1 times phi 3, etc. That's it. Then I can go to the next line and say E times phi 2 is equal to whatever's here times phi 1 plus whatever's here times phi 2, etc. So when I write a matrix equation like this, it really is a kind of organized way of writing n separate algebraic equations. So that's the basic point, that what you're doing is we're starting with a differential equation and turning it into a set of algebraic equations, which you can write in a compact way like a matrix. Now, once you have it in the form of a matrix, of course, the advantage is then, after that solving it, there are very powerful numerical programs for this. And of course, MATLAB is particularly good at that. So as far as MATLAB is concerned, you would just have to send it this matrix and ask for its eigenvalues and eigenvectors. And it will come back and give you the values of energy for which it can find solutions. So those are the eigenvalues. And then corresponding to each eigenvalue, it will give you the eigenvector. So let's say we call this matrix H. So once you have formed this matrix, what takes you a little work is to write that matrix. You see. But once you have written that matrix, then all you do is write a command like this in MATLAB, that V, D equals, say, eigenvector. So that's the matrix you have to first form on your computer. You write down that matrix, that n by n matrix, whatever it is, and then you write this command. And what it will do is it will take this matrix, let's say it's a 10 by 10 matrix, and it will return you two 10 by 10 matrices. This one will be a diagonal matrix. Again, 10 by 10. It's a diagonal matrix whose diagonal elements are the eigenvalues that you are looking for. And this is another 10 by 10 matrix, but this is not diagonal. Here, the first column is like the eigenvector corresponding to that first eigenvalue. The second column is the eigenvector corresponding to the second eigenvalue, and so on. So that's it. So these are the eigenvalues, those are the eigenvectors. And you have it solved. That's it. You know, as I said, one of the important insights into all this is the idea, is the fact that when you solve a differential equation like this, it's like with some boundary conditions, like the box boundary conditions that we talked about last day. It's like putting an electron in a box. You can only find solutions at certain specific energies. And as I said, the hydrogen atom, that's also kind of like a box, a complicated box. And when the electron gets stuck in there, you get certain discrete energies. So why is it that you can only find solutions at certain energies? Well, that's what we tried to discuss last day. From this point of view, you can see that once you have set up a matrix and you ask for its eigenvalues, I mean, those are basically the allowed energies at which you can find solutions to that set of equations. See? Those are the eigenvalues. So if you had managed to write this H for the hydrogen atom, you know, which needs a little more discussion because this is in three dimensions and all that, which I'll get to. That takes a little more discussion. But if you did that and asked for its eigenvalues, then MATLAB would give you these levels right away. That's it. Yeah. Okay. So what I want to talk about then for most of this class is how to write that H, really. In fact, let me tell you the result first, right away. So, and then I'll try to justify it. Now, one interesting thing is this, that when you have two terms like this, because it's all linear, when I write this matrix version for this thing, I can write something for this and something for this, and then the total thing is just a sum. So in other words, there's a matrix corresponding to this, and there's a matrix corresponding to that. And it's additive. So the overall matrix is just H1 plus H2. Okay? Now, the one that's easiest to write down, though, is the matrix for this one. So let me first tell you how to write this matrix. Okay? This one takes a little more work. Okay, I guess I can use this here. So the way this would work is, let's forget this term as if it's not even there. Let's just look at the rest of it. So the equation we have is E phi x is equal to u of x times phi of x. That's the equation we have when x is a continuous variable. So let us choose a particular point. You know, when I make it discrete, these points are like, I could label them like 1, 2, 3, etc. So I've got various numbers there. So we choose a particular number, say n. And this is n minus 1. That's say n plus 1. So let's say go to the point n. Now, phi at that point, that's of course what I've called like phi n. So I would write e phi n. So what am I doing? Well, x was a continuous variable. Now it's a discrete lattice, so I'm going to that point, x equals n times a, I guess, at that point. And I'm saying, let's write down this equation at that point. So that will be e phi n is equal to u at x equals, you know, at that point, whatever that is, xn times phi n. So that's the differential equation, quote unquote. I mean, it's not really a differential equation anymore because I've dropped the differential operator, for to be simple. So that was the original equation. And what I'm now doing is turning it into a whole set of algebraic equations. So I could put n equals 1, I'd get e phi 1 is equal to whatever u happens to be at that point times phi 1. E phi 2, whatever u happens to be at that point times phi 2, etc. That's it. And that way I'll get n algebraic equations out of it. What used to be one continuous equation will be now n algebraic equations. So can you help me with what that set of equations, you know, when I write it like this, this represents 100 algebraic equations. I mean, 100, by 100, I mean capital N, whatever that number is. I got capital N algebraic equations, and I'd like to write them in the form of a matrix. So can you help me with what this matrix would look like? Right. The important thing is it would look diagonal. Why is that? Well, because, you see, the first equation will be E phi 1 equals something times phi 1. So I say, okay, E phi 1 is equal to something times phi 1, and that something should, of course, go right here. And then, since it doesn't involve anything from phi 2, phi 3, etc., I just put zeros. Okay? So that way I filled up the first row. Then we go on to the second row. We say, okay, now E phi 2 is equal to, you know, this something times phi 2. Okay, so we go to that line. E phi 2 is equal to something times phi 2, which means that first point I put 0 because that number is going to multiply the phi 1 out there. But the phi 2 will be the next guy. So I'll put it here. And then it will be again a bunch of zeros. And so on. So every line you fill up, the next one when you try to fill up, you'll have two zeros, and then you at x3, and so on. So the point is, as someone pointed out, that basically then in matrix form, what you'd have is a diagonal matrix with non-zero elements only along the diagonal. And what are those non-zero values? Well, it's just the value of u at different points along your lattice. So at x1, whatever u happens to be right here, that's what goes there. Whatever it happens to be right there, that's what goes to the next one, third one, and so on. And you fill it out. So that's easy. Okay, so as I said, what I need to describe to you is how to write down this full matrix. And what I've just described to you is how to write down the matrix corresponding to that one. That's easy enough. Okay? So we could say that, I suppose, mathematically, I could write that result up here. When I turn this into a matrix, then u of x becomes, when you try to write it into a matrix as a matrix element there, you could say it would be like whatever the value is at n, delta nm. This is a symbol that often people use. It's called the Kronecker delta. And the definition of this symbol is that it is 1 if the two indices are equal. And it's 0 if the two indices are not equal. So what we are saying is that when we take, if you have an operator like u of x, and you are trying to write the corresponding matrix element, you're trying to write the nm matrix element of the matrix that represents it, then what it should be is, firstly, it should be diagonal, which means you don't get anything unless n is equal to m. And then for the diagonal element, the strength should be this. Right? Of course, you could have, instead of n, have written m here. Wouldn't make any difference, because unless n is equal to m, you don't get anything anyway. So either one way would be fine. So this would be a mathematical way of saying what we just kind of reasoned. Okay? Yeah?
What is the physical meaning of u?
U is the potential that... So, you know, this is this potential in the Schrodinger equation. So in the context of the hydrogen atom, it would have been the potential that the electron sees due to the nucleus. In the context of the problem you are solving, this could be whatever the potential an electron feels due to your solid, due to the gate, all the external things. So whatever this potential in here. You know, like when we were discussing that nano device model, I had put in a U there, and we put in just one number. In general, though, you have a whole set of points here, and you could have a U of X, something that's a little different on this side and a little different on that side. And you could be solving the Schrodinger equation with that UX in it, for example. So it's the potential that the electron feels. Only caveat, you know, it's actually the potential energy. What that means is if the potential is positive, that U we are talking about is actually negative. So for example, in the hydrogen atom, as you know, this potential comes from the positive nucleus, the protons. So actually the potential is positive, but that potential energy actually is negative. It is minus ZQ squared over 4 pi epsilon r. That's the only thing to remember. This is potential energy, so it's the negative of the potential. That's all. Okay. So, as I said, writing the matrix corresponding to this part then is quite straightforward. This is it. What needs a little more discussion is this one. So let's try to do that one. So here again, let's write this equation and just drop this one. We know what to do with that anyway, so let's focus on the one we don't understand. So write this. E phi of x is equal to now, so what we do is go to a particular point n right here and try to write this equation at that point. And so what we get is something like this, E phi n, that's easy enough. Here you have a constant minus h bar square over 2m, that's fine. Now the tricky part is this derivative, you see? And so the thing is, what I want to write is the second derivative at this point. See? So second derivative of this function at this point. So the way we approximate it is by saying, let us look at the first derivative somewhere here, and the first derivative somewhere here, and see how much they differ from each other. Because the second derivative is equal to the change in the first derivative divided by that distance a. As you know, anytime you have a function and you're trying to write its derivative at this point, what you do is you look for the function a little ahead of you, a little behind you, take that difference and divide it by the distance. That's a good way to approximate what the derivative is right there. Okay. Now, this is the second derivative of phi. What that means is it's like the derivative of the derivative itself. So what we want is to know what this derivative is right here, what it is right there, and look at that difference. So what I do is to approximate this, and this is, of course, approximate only. So I write this as d phi dx, you know, a little bit left of n and a little bit ahead of n. So I'd write n plus a half minus d phi dx at n minus a half. So I'm trying to write d2 phi dx2 at n, at the point n. And I'm writing it as the difference between what the d phi dx is a little bit in front and a little bit behind. And then I divide the whole thing with a. That's it. So this is this, when I call this the method of finite differences, this is where this finite difference comes in. It is approximating the derivative with a difference like this. Now, what makes it a little harder is I have to do this one more time. And that is, when you are talking about the d phi dx here, I'd like to write it as the difference between the function here and the function there. You see? So just as I took d2 phi dx2 and made it into a difference between 2 d phi dx, similarly I'll take the d phi dx and write it as the difference between what it is at the two ends. So in other words, I'll take, okay, let me take this off. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to write this as phi at n plus 1 minus phi at n divided by a. So I want to know, I'm trying to write d phi dx right here, between n and n plus 1. And I'll write it as the difference between what is the function on this side, what is the function on this side, the difference divided by a. Now, can you help me with what I should do with the second term? That's phi n minus 1 over. That's it. Okay. So now we can kind of collect all this together, and it would become something like this. Can you tell me what goes inside? What I've done is, you see, there was an a here and an a there. I kind of took those two together and put an a square here. But inside here, I should have these phi n plus 1s, and so on. So can you help me with what goes in there?
Phi n plus 1 plus phi n minus 1 minus 2 phi n.
Right. So basically, it's this minus this. So it's phi n plus 1 minus phi n plus phi n minus 1, because there's a minus in front of it, it kind of changes those signs. Okay? So you end up with this minus 2 phi n plus phi n plus 1 plus phi n minus 1. That's all. So that minus phi n and that minus phi n that I've put together as minus 2 phi n, and then plus phi n plus 1 plus phi n minus 1. That's it. And since I have a minus here, I guess it's a little more convenient to take this out of here, turn that into a plus, and turn those into minuses. That's all. You see, I had this extra minus here just because of that minus h bar square over 2m in the first place. That's where it all came from. Okay, so that's the end result. So I could write all this together then as E phi n is equal to So I've just taken that result, put it up here, nothing new. This is it. And this quantity here, it has the dimensions of energy that you can see. This is energy, and this is also energy, and these are all dimensionless numbers there. And this, let me call it T0. Actually, in the literature, people often write it as just T. And just to avoid any confusion with time, I put a T0 there. That's it. So that has the dimensions of energy. And this, you see, depends on your lattice spacing, this A that you use. It will depend on that. Okay. That's it. So now can you help me with how to fill out that matrix? So this is, as I said, what we did was we took that differential equation, went to a particular point, and wrote it out. And of course, I could go to any point I want. So I could write E phi 1 equals whatever it is. I could write E phi 2 equals whatever it is. That way, I'd get n equations. That's the n algebraic equations, which then I could arrange in the form of a matrix. And then that matrix I can send MATLAB. Right? So my question is, what would this matrix now look like? You know, the matrix for this one was easy. It was diagonal. What about this one? Right. You see, if it was just this, you know, if those two terms were not there, then it would have been purely diagonal again. E phi 1, 2 t 0 times phi 1. E phi 2, 2 t 0 times phi 2. That would be easy. So then you'd just have two t zeros along the diagonal. That'd be it. If this were the only term. But then I got a phi n plus 1 and a phi n minus 1. So one of them, of course, contributes to the upper diagonal. If this multiplies phi n, this is what multiplies phi n plus 1. It's the next one over. And the phi n minus 1 comes from the lower diagonal. So when you write out this matrix, basically you'll have stuff on the upper diagonal and stuff on the lower diagonal, and zeros everywhere else. Okay? And those upper diagonals and lower diagonals will be equal, and they will have a magnitude of minus T0. Just as the diagonal was 2T0, these would be minus T0. That's it. Done. Yes, please.
What do we take when we take, say, n is equal to 0?
Right. That's the boundary condition issue. I'll come to that in a minute. Very good point. Yeah. So again, if I had to write this mathematically, I'd have written h n m. And this is when we are doing minus h bar square over 2m d2 dx2. If you had to write the corresponding h n m, it would look like 2 t naught delta nm plus, or rather minus, t naught delta n plus 1 comma m, and then minus t naught delta n minus 1 comma m. Yeah. This, you don't really need it, though. I mean, it's just that mathematically often people would write it this way. And you can kind of see why, how that works, because this is this Kronecker delta, which is non-zero only if n is equal to m. So here, it is non-zero only if n plus 1 is equal to m. This is non-zero only if n minus 1 is equal to m. So mathematically, often people write it this way. But physically, of course, this means exactly what we just talked about. And the only thing you'd have to know is, like in MATLAB, what command it is that allows you to set up a matrix like this. And there's, you know, you can easily look it up. There's very simple commands with which you can easily set up a matrix with the diagonals, or with something that goes on the upper diagonal, or something that goes on the lower diagonal. That's easy to set up. Okay. Now, one of the points that we had discussed last day was that that you can write down the solutions to this problem analytically if you didn't have the u of x. This is one point that I've stressed, that in differential equations, if you had a differential equation with constant coefficients, and if this u of x were not there, or if it were just a constant, then this would satisfy that criteria. And then you can immediately write the solution in the form of exponential ikx and get the dispersion relation and et cetera. Right? That's one very important thing to remember. Because the real power of the numerical method is that once you have set it up, you can put in any u of x and check what happens. I mean, as far as this calculation is concerned, if you change u of x, all you do is change these diagonal elements. Add a new set of diagonal elements in there. Ask MATLAB to find its eigenvalues, eigenvectors, is instantaneous. I mean, with a 100 by 100 matrix, the answers would just come back right away on your laptop. It's really that simple. Okay? So that's really the power of the numerical method, how easily you can handle all this. Whereas the analytical, it's only for very special functions u of x that you actually may have an analytical solution. But the simplest one that you should always remember, one that you should always know is that the solution that corresponds to this being a constant, you know, zero or any constant, really. Because if it's a constant, then solutions can be written in the form of exponential ikx. And then depending on the boundary conditions, you may want to write them as sines and cosines or exponentials, etc. Right? That one you should be aware of. And that always is a very good check for your numerical method. That is, whenever you have set up this numerical method, there's a 100 ways of making a mistake so it doesn't work. You know, because you missed a minus sign somewhere, because you didn't quite set it up right. And so it's always good to do a problem where you know the answers and see if you are getting it right. Okay? So a very good problem to work is the problem where this is just a constant. In fact, let me just put it to zero. So let's say we're just doing this one. Now, okay, so in that case, I'd set up a matrix like this. I don't even have to worry about the u. This just looks like so, and we go to MATLAB, ask for its thing. But one thing I discussed last day is that the actual answers would be a little bit different depending on whether we use these periodic boundary conditions or the box boundary conditions. If you remember, last day we talked about these two possible problems. One is the box boundary conditions, where you assume that the wave function has to go to zero at the ends. You know, inside it can do whatever it wants, but at the ends, it has to go to zero because you have these infinite walls there. That was the one possible thing. And in that case, you write the solutions as sine kx. X equals zero. This is x equals L. And then k is restricted to, what are the allowed values of k in this case? In this case, it will be actually pi over L, because sine kL must be equal to 0, because at this point it has to go to 0. So kn times L should be equal to pi, so kn is pi over L. Now the other example I mentioned is this periodic boundary condition case. And when you do periodic boundary conditions, the solutions can be written as exponential plus ikx or minus ikx, either one. And now the corresponding k's are given by 2 pi over L. Because in this case, it's not like the wave function has to be zero anywhere. It is just that the wave function, every time you go around by L, should come back to the same value. And so k times L should be just be equal to 2 pi. And this, so in that sense, there's a big difference between these two. This is what I'd call the box boundary condition, and this is what people call the periodic boundary conditions. And the solutions are a little bit different because the allowed values of k are a little bit different. And once you have the allowed values of k, how do you get the allowed values of energy? Because finally, of course, what you really want is the energy. Can you help me? How do you go from k to e? That's this dispersion relation. And dispersion relation is, as you know, once you assume e to the power ikx, this just becomes like ik multiplied twice. That's minus k square. And so e is equal to h bar square k square over 2m. Right? That's this dispersion relation that we had talked about. And that applies to all solutions of this form. And the thing is, this is also kind of like this because it's really a linear combination of two terms of this type. And in these linear equations, as long as you have two solutions with the same energy, you can always superpose them any way you want. So that works. So this is, so for every k, you'd do this and get the energies. So that would be the analytical way of doing it. And this is a very good example to remember because once you have set this up numerically, you kind of want to check against that. Because this is where you know what the answers should be. See if you get that here. Now, what's not clear is, how do I distinguish between this boundary condition and that boundary condition? Because in setting up this matrix, we never really talked about a boundary condition. You see? And the point I wanted to make is, let's first talk about the, I guess, in either case, the point to note is that the boundary condition really appears where, you know, one of you asked me this question, that what do I do at the ends? That's where it really comes up. Why? Because you see, any place you write this equation, the equation, if you remember, what we had was that E phi n is equal to 2t0 phi n, and then minus t0 phi n minus 1, and minus t0 phi n plus 1. If you remember, this is the equation we had. So when you go to one of these end points, you have E phi 1 is equal to 2t0 phi 1 minus t0 phi 2. But what you really want to put is a minus t0 here that would kind of multiply a phi 0 that's not quite there. You see? Because if your lattice hadn't quite ended at point 1, so if this is the point 1, and if there were a point zero somewhere here, then you would have actually put a minus t0 here and it would have multiplied the phi 0. But it's just that the lattice kind of ended there. We don't really have a phi 0. So one way to do it is ignore it completely. So don't even worry about it. So we don't put anything. Now, what does that amount to? That amounts to saying that phi 0 is 0. So in a way, just ignoring it implements the box boundary condition, sort of. In the sense that you're doing all your calculations on these points, and then when you come to the end, this is like point one, you have a minus t0 times phi0, and you just ignore it completely, which basically says you're putting phi0 equal to 0. And the same at the other end. You're kind of saying phi n is the phi n plus 1 that wants to be there is not there. I mean, we just make it zero. So ignoring it, if you just ignore it, you automatically get this. That's it. Okay? Now, the periodic one is a little more tricky, because the periodic one basically means that you have a point, you know, like one here, two here, and you're going round, and then you come here and that's n. And so, the point zero is really the same as point n. That's the thing. In a periodic boundary condition, you don't say that psi zero is zero. That's the box boundary condition. Here what you say is point zero is really the same as point n. So my question is, then what should we do with this minus t0?
Put it at the end of the first row.
Right. Because this is what wants to multiply phi 0, but then phi 0 has no place in my set of equations. I don't even have a phi 0. But 0 is the same as point n. So what I'll do is I'll take this minus t0 and put it in such a place that it would multiply the phi of n. And that, of course, is the last point here. This multiplies phi of n. Okay. And here it works the other way. This is like when you have come to n and you're now trying to figure out what to do with the minus t0 that wants to multiply a phi n plus 1 that isn't really there. Put it back up front because n plus 1 is really back to point 1. So you say, okay, let me just take the minus t0 and I'll put it here. Okay. So these two extra terms then, if you put it n, it just turns your matrix into, it takes care of the periodic boundary conditions, essentially. That's it. You see? So you have the box and the periodic one. And the only difference is this. Okay? Now, one interesting point then, you might say, okay, so if I put in minus t0s here, then if I look at the eigenvectors, you know, as I said, you set up this matrix and then you ask MATLAB to return you the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors. And the eigenvalues should go according to that equation with kn equals 2 pi over L. Right? And you'll find that the lowest ones will match. When you go to higher eigenvalues and eigenvectors, you'll find it won't match very well. And the reason is that when you go to higher ones, usually, as you go higher in energy, these things are oscillating more and more. And once it starts oscillating too much, it means that your lattice is really not doing justice to it anymore. It's the lower ones where, you know, it changes slowly from one point to another. That's when it works very well, accurately. The higher ones won't work very well because if it's changing significantly from one lattice point to the other, then it's not really working anymore. So that's what you'll find. If you plot against this one, you'll find all the lower ones match beautifully. Upper ones are not quite there. Okay? But there's another interesting point, and that is, if you look at the eigenvectors. Yes, please.
How correct is it to say that we have an infinite wall?
How?
We have to hit the boundaries. If we have the infinite wall, I mean, okay, that is the zero at the both ends. But if you don't have the infinite walls, that means, the wave just goes through
the right. Right. So what your question is how would you handle, say, a problem like this one? So you have some well here and some well that's like this, so that this isn't really infinite. So that the wave function in that case, when you calculate it, should actually look something like this. It won't really go to zero there, but will go on, you know, penetrate a little further. Right? Now, when you're doing this analytically, then people have a way of writing solutions here and here and matching them across the boundary and so on. But numerically, if I was doing this, I'd say that I'd put an infinite wall somewhere here. Far away from where the wave function is, so at a point where I expect the wave function to be zero anyway.